Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill them all up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff
McClure, where we may be heard to say embarrassing things.
Like, we deem.
Yes, we do. So, before we start talking about what we like to talk about, we have to talk about other things that we kind of like to talk about. Disclosures! Yeah, we're weird. Why do we like this to talk about disclosures? Because part of what we do, and we'll even talk about that in the disclosure, the Personal Wealth Coach is the name of this program. It's also the name of the business that is represented by the same two guys that are talking on the radio, the Personal Wealth Coach. The business is registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission as an investment advisor. What does that mean? It means it has to offer fiduciary advice and fully disclose conflicts of interest and all fees and compensation. Okay, that's working with individual people. We can't do that on the radio. So even though we're the firm and the people representing the firm are the same people as on the radio here, this is an educational program rather than advice. We're not going to tell you what you should buy or sell on here because that would be advice and we don't know who you are. It'd be like saying nobody should buy a backhoe. Well, some people clearly need to buy a backhoe and other people it would be a serious waste of their money. So just because that firm and we are registered with the SEC doesn't mean that the SEC has in any way given their approval or attaboy to us. That's just the regulatory authority. It's like, that'd be like saying, I do my taxes through the IRS, so they like me. Nope, that's not what government does. Sorry. saying that this is educational, even though the firm's registered as fiduciary. Also, if we're giving advice on the air, you could probably sue us because everybody's listening and advice that we give has to be customized to the person. That'd be a bit serious privacy violation, all kinds of issues there. That's why we like to give disclosures. On this educational program, we come up with information. Would you like to tell them about that information?
Wow, that was an impressive disclosure. The information we present on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to its accuracy or completeness.
That was also quite a disclosure.
Mm-hmm. I think probably news broadcasts should have that disclosure.
Yeah.
They're not regulated by the SEC.
Why do you like giving that disclosure so much?
I don't know. Why do I like doing what I do so much?
I don't know.
Why do I like digging through lots and lots and lots of mutual funds and trying to find the what I think will be the best performers in the lowest cost mutual funds?
Because we're weird. Why do I
get a big thrill out of allocating portfolios and meeting with clients? I don't know.
It's just weird. I say the word Excel to some people and they turn green in the face and look like they're going to show me what they ate. And I get this feeling of fluttery butterflies when I think about spreadsheets. Now, for some reason, I'm still able to speak to people in a semi-coherent way where most of my friends that are Excel people will speak to me in Excel language. And when we leave that language, it gets very awkward. So I don't know. I am gifted in being able to translate Excel. That's another disclosure. There we go.
Yes.
Disclosure in that we like to read prospectuses. Weird.
Whoa. Now you've gone beyond my ken.
That's too hard even for you?
I don't like to read prospectuses. I like reading about prospectuses from people who read prospectuses. But it's a real pain in the butt to read a prospectus because it is not written to be read by normal human beings.
Yeah, so this is why I like to read them. I point at them occasionally and go, I know what you did there. So I have this little like, I'll get you. I know. So that's another disclosure.
That's a disclosure, yeah.
Yeah, about who we are. We're also bald. Jeff is bald with a white beard, and Jake is bald with the salt and pepper.
Mostly black.
Mostly pepper. little salt.
Your beard is much longer than mine.
Yes. Your age is much older than mine. So Jeff is my dad. I'm Jake. And most people don't know that in listening to this program. We have been working together for 31 years. And we're both alive still, which is amazing. Father-son teams generally end in mayhem, homicide investigations and things like that. Somehow we're still hanging out.
Speaking of reading prospectuses.
Oh, we do have to get to the market too. I mean, but
what we just got our question from the guy you were concerned might be ill today.
Yes, we were concerned about you, Inquisitor John, because we hadn't received one yet. We were hoping you were okay.
Man, that is an interesting question. We'll get to that.
Yes. All right. This is a good one. It's about investing in leveraged assets. We'll get
triple
to that one.
Leveraged assets.
Right, we'll explain why we think that is humorous.
A cold sweat broke out on my forehead when he said that.
The nervous laughter of why would anyone do that to themselves? Okay.
Well,
what happened in the market?
Well, it was an interesting week in the market. Actually, the market was still doing its thing, saying, okay, we pretty much got this figured out. Everything's cool. Until first the Federal Reserve's notes from its last meeting last month came out, and they looked at that, and the market actually rose a little bit after that. And then, it's terrible. Voting members of the Federal Reserve Board. These are the people, there's members of the Federal Reserve Board, and then there's voting members of the Federal Reserve Board. And the voting members of the Federal Reserve Board started giving speeches saying, golly, guys, we're really, really, really serious about raising interest rates. We are really, really, really going to raise interest rates. And some of them, enough of them that scared people, said at their next meeting in September, I am leaning towards raising interest rates 0.75%, short-term interest rates. And this immediately started a mild, very mild panic in the market where people said, oh, no, no, they're going to overtighten. They're going to do terrible. The world's going to come to an end. Run, run, run. Our words to that effect. So what happened, if you look 1 week at a time as we do, after rising for 4 weeks, the S&P 500 index reduced its value, was reduced in value by 1.21% for the fell to 4228.48. Now, let's look at that from a little different perspective. It is now down 11.78% from its high in January. And if you looked in January at the peak of the market and you came back and looked now, we'd just barely be in a correction. But it's up 15.23% from its low in June, which means we're not back in the bull market yet by some definitions. It is now down 4.8% from a year ago, but is up 47.57% from 3 years ago. I know there's a lot of numbers. The one, if you're an investor, that I recommend you focus on is the 47.57. If you are an investor and not a speculator, and I don't think we have a lot of speculators who listen to this radio program, then you're in it for hopefully at least 10 years when you invest. 3 years is a relatively short period of time, but still, if you're looking at 3 years, you still are in the general heading of investor. 47% in 3 years. Golly bum, guys. That is a heck of a rise in 3 years. It's way above historic norms. And why do I say 3 years? Well, that takes us back before the pandemic. It's like if you had gone away 3 years ago and come back and found that the S&P 500 was up 47.57%, you'd be absolutely thrilled. As opposed to the people who say, oh, no, we're in a bear market. The world's coming to an end. Our words to that effect. Well, anyway.
Well, the world, saying the world is coming to an end, maybe a long way in the future, but it is coming to an end. And if you consider it from simply the geometry of it, the end of the world is the surface of the planet. And all you have to do is jump upward and you have jumped off the edge of the planet. So we have reached the end of the planet, of the world, and it is wherever you are.
Yeah, well, in a metaphorical sense, the end of the world is the end of existence for civilization. So, nah, it's not happening.
Well, the planet it just seems very egocentric to call the world civilization, if you know what I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, but we are egocentric. Anyway.
Okay, back to the market.
The other equity index we follow is the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index. Why? Because the S&P 500 tends to be large cap growth companies, very large companies where the stock is priced, the stocks of the companies are priced in the market based on their presumed growth in earnings into the future. The other side of the S&P 500 is a section of the market that's called value, where the stocks are generally priced. The stocks of companies there are generally priced according to their perceived internal value metrics. In other words, this, if you look, it's kind of like if you're buying a piece of real estate, odds are you'd look at the value of the real estate. The value, if you're buying a real estate company, you look at all of its real estate and say, what would be the value if we sold all those pieces of real estate? And if the stock price is above the value of the real estate, it's probably a growth company. If it's below the value of the real estate or at the value of the real estate company owned, it'd be called a value company. So that's a different kind of company. And we look at mid-cap because there are no small caps in the S&P 500. So mid-cap is the smallest part of the S&P 500 oriented, and it's the part mid-cap value is oriented on value. So it's the other corner of the S&P 500. Anyway, it dropped 1.20% this week to 2471.19. That's the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index. It's now down 4.85 from January when it hit its high. But it is up, and I think this is fascinating to me. It is up 0.73% from 1 year ago. Yay! First time in a long time we have seen a positive one-year return in the market anywhere. And there it is. It's pleasant, and I like it. Not that it means anything. So the concern in the stock market, by the way, this week was that the Federal Reserve would raise interest rates too far, too fast, and cause a recession, which is an interesting concept by itself. The other concern in the market right now is that the Federal Reserve will not raise interest rates fast enough and far enough and will have runaway inflation. So
it's the fear versus the fear, waging a battle.
Right. It's fear versus fear. And by the way, that is another indication that we're in a bull market. There's an old saying, a bull market climbs a wall of worry. I know that by suggesting we're in a bull market and have continued to be in a bull market during this down period in the market puts me in a very small minority. But yeah. I think this is a temporary interruption in a secular bull market.
Okay.
And all I have to do is point to the 47.57% rise in 3 years and say, you're not calling. You're calling that a bear market, anyway.
But you can say that this is my quibble here. This is word nerd 101. You could say that about the entire history of the market and say it's never had a bear market because the long term of the market return is so positive.
I would beg to differ with you on that.
I mean, I'm just taking it to its logical conclusion. If you say a 20% drop isn't a bear. And you say, if we look at 3 years or longer. So this is a valid argument, by the way, because one of the things that our firm that we do is we take monthly numbers rather than daily numbers when we're measuring ups and downs in the market. And that means that while the market had a bear, in our data, it didn't appear for several months. And both ways of measuring are extremely valid.
We kind of feel like it had a cow.
Right. We had a bit of a cow. Yeah.
Well, I would consider the period of time from 1973 to 1982 to be a bear market.
A secular bear market, because we had little bulls right in there too. Yeah. So
a secular bear market.
This is why we talk about secular and cyclical. And I know people have trouble understanding the difference between bear and bull. And now we're adding to it. One of them's on a bicycle and one of them is not a priest, a secular bear and a cyclical bear. Just imagine that for a second.
Oh, boy. Anyway.
Yeah.
We are in and continue to be in what is known in academia, where they have the nuts, you know, the academia nuts.
Right. Bears on the bicycles. Yeah.
Right. We're in a secular bull market. Now, bull markets don't last forever, but this one looks pretty healthy. Anyway,
One more piece, because we've thoroughly confused them now, but we've given them all the anchor points to actually remember this. A secular bear or a secular bull is a much longer trend. And if you look at like history throughout time and you look at industrial revolutions, We entered a secular bull market there. And then you have a drop in that, and there's a secular bear market. Now, you can have little bulls and little bears running around in the middle of that mix, which causes it to be cyclical. These are just normal part of any business growth. There's not a great deal of new technology, or there is a great deal of new technology. If there's a lot of new technology, bear markets tend to be short.
Right.
So that's a secular bull.
It might help people to recognize something, and because people like to tie politics to the market. The secular bear, the last secular bear we had, began with our losing in Vietnam and Richard Nixon. And a lot of our listeners remember Richard Nixon, and they remember us losing in Vietnam. And the Jimmy Carter never actually said this, but it was credited to him. The national malaise has fallen across the country, or something to that effect.
I don't know why he was talking about mayonnaise. What?
Right.
Yeah.
Malaise. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. And he was right. And we did have some problems. And the secular bull that we're in began during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. No. It began with, oddly enough, two severe recessions generated by Paul Volcker, who Jimmy Carter appointed to the position, and who probably lost the presidency for Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan leaving him in place so he could start another recession. And from that, we began a secular bull market, and we can get into that more later. Really, but we didn't talk about
the information revolution really started at that point. That's when computers really took off, and that's why we've been in this. We're not done tapping new bits of that technology. We think we're still in a secular bull.
Right, exactly. Anyway, boy, that's...
that was a big rabbit trail in the news about the market.
If you're inside a bull, it's kind of dark. Anyway, the 10-year U.S. Treasury note yield. Now, why do we report on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note yield so consistently? Because it is the benchmark for all other interest rates. If it rises, other interest rates tend to rise. If it falls, other interest rates tend to fall. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note yield climbed this week as the stock market fell. Now, what does that mean? That means that if you owned a portfolio of bonds, as the stock market went down this week, so did your portfolio of bonds, which kind of disabuses a myth. There's this myth out there that if you own stocks and bonds, when the stocks go up, the bonds will go down. When the bonds go up, the stocks will go down. Ain't happened in some time. Never was consistent. It was a mild anomaly at one point, and somehow it got stuck in our brains. It just ain't so, folks. Anyway,
in academia, that's called stocks and bonds generally tend to have a positive correlation. They have a positive. It's just not a high positive correlation. That's what it's just what you said, that they tend to go down and up at the same time. So
anyway,
there you go.
The 10-year U.S. Treasury note ended the week yielding 2.97%, which is up about 4.75% from where it was last week, which means interest rates went up at the 10-year point. The Treasury yield curve remains inverted, the 2-year note, and this is how the best way to measure the Treasury yield curve to determine what it's trying to communicate, if it's trying to communicate anything. The 10-year yield on Treasuries is 2.97. Well, since 2.97 is 2.97, and the 2-year note is yielding 3.23%. That means the 2-year note has a higher interest rate than the 10-year note, and that's called an inverted yield curve. Inverted yield curves, let's put it like this. Every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve, but every inverted yield curve does not create a recession.
An SAT question. All chickens have feathers. Not all feathers have chickens. Let me see.
So the Treasury yield curve could be forecasting a recession sometime in the next 18 or so months. And historically, about 80% of the time when it does that, we get a recession. However, it always could be part of the 20%, and it could be different because the Federal Reserve is doing some things they've never done before with the interest yield curve. That's all beside the point. West Texas, this is the good news now. West Texas Intermediate crude oil, which is the stuff they pump out of the ground in West Texas, that eventually becomes the gasoline that you burn, or diesel or whatever you burn in your vehicle. It dropped 2% to $89.97 per barrel.
That's good news to a lot of people and bad news to a few people.
Right. Well, I don't...
They really want that price to stay up because that's all profitability. Because they own the oil that they're selling.
But those are the people who remember when you had to pay somebody $40 to take a barrel of their oil off their property.
This is still good news for them compared to that. Much better than that.
And there's a whole wealth of questions in my mind that haven't been answered as to why the price of oil is this inexpensive at this point, considering that a very significant portion of the oil supply for the planet, Russia's oil supply, is mostly not being delivered right now. It's not going anywhere. But I got some partial answers to that, but we'll see how that works out. Anyway, that is the big stuff in the market. There's lots of other stuff in the market, but you don't want to hear it.
Yeah. Well, maybe they do, but we don't want to talk about it. Okay. Well, maybe we do. We just don't have time. All right. So we do have a question, though, from Inquisitor John. We were worried, John. We don't want to give you any pressure or anything, but you're so consistent that when we didn't get one before the program, we were concerned.
We were concerned. I would have called afterwards to find out if you were okay.
His question has the subject email. And by the way, if you guys want to email us questions as well, we are reading them and answering them as we get to them. The email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com. That's Jeff as in Jeffrey. And like J-E-F-F at TangoPapaWhiskeyCharlie.com or ThePersonalWealthCoach.com, preferably with Jake@TPWC.com as well, so that we can both see them. So John's emailed us this question. The subject is triple leveraged ETF. Saw this investment in the Wall Street Journal. How can something triple leveraged be an investment? And he has quotes around triple leveraged and quotes around investment. Would you like to answer this? What is triple leveraged anyway?
Well, leveraged means somebody borrows money to invest in the market.
Right. Or into anything. Like you're leveraged in your house if you have a mortgage.
What you're actually talking about is something that is a product that's offered by a company called ProShares. And it's called a 3X ETF. The purpose in that is if you are absolutely positive that the stock market is going to go up and you were to purchase a triple leveraged ETF, theoretically, if the market went up 5%, your investment would go up 15%. So
that's the theoretical.
Because you have only 1/3 of the money that was invested was actually your money that was invested. And 2/3 of the money was money that was borrowed from someplace else. Now, it doesn't quite work out that way because the people from whom the money is borrowed charge interest. So it's not quite 3x, but that's the whole idea.
That's why it's called 3x.
Now, the problem, of course, is if the market goes down.
Wait, no, not if.
During the period you own it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. If it goes down during the period you own it. Yes.
If it goes down 5%, you lose 15%. And if it goes down a bunch, and bunch is a scientific term that we use to generalize about things, the whole thing could shut down and you could lose everything.
Here's one of the factors involved in leverage. Why is it called leverage? When you, this early invention by bald apes,
Archimedes,
the bald apes is a group got together and said, we will use this stick to pick up that rock easier. Taking a loan from someone is borrowing their energy, if you will, or leveraging their assets and your assets to buy something, and you have an agreement that you will pay them back. If you're triple leveraged, that means that you owe 3x as much. And there are rules in the market because during the crash of 1929, I know that was a long time ago. We're getting up on 100 years. Neither of us personally remember it, but we've studied it a lot. There was no limitation on how much you could borrow against your portfolio. So you could borrow 150% of the value of your portfolio, but when the market cratered, you couldn't pay any of it back. So not only did you lose your value, the lenders lost their value. So it tripled, in many cases, the losses. Well, the government got together, and the way governments do, they generally make changes after things break, and it thoroughly broke there. So they got together and they came up with a series of laws and regulations on banks and loans. Generally, the regulations are put together under one big clause called Reg T, which means if you're borrowing money to invest it in the marketplace, you're limited on how much you can borrow against your portfolio to 50%. That's Reg T. You can only borrow half of the value of your portfolio. And when your portfolio drops enough that you've got more than 50% borrowed, something called a margin call occurs, where the person you have borrowed from, usually some big corporation, calls you and says, what do you want to sell? And you say, I don't want to sell anything right now. The market's down. Well, you're below your collateral value, so you need to sell something to bring your liquid value up. But if I sell now, it's going to be at a big loss. So you have a forced fire sale when the market's down on leveraged money. And when it's triple leveraged, that forced fire sale comes, it's more like a bomb-induced tornado fire sale rather than fire sale. And that can cause highly leveraged portfolios to just simply collapse in value. And it can cause the overall market to drop faster because of those forced sales, because the market's down. That was a very long-winded explanation of leveraging and the risks of it. So how, this back to the question, how can something that's triple leveraged as an ETF be called an investment?
It isn't really in many senses. It's a speculatory purchase. Now, let me give you an example of why we don't do that. If on January 1st you had bought a triple leveraged ETF, I just looked at the prime triple leveraged ETF that's out there, and I think it's the one to which he is referring. Your loss in the market right now, so far this year, would be about 59%.
That's even with the recovery that we've seen over the past month?
Yes.
Yep, still down 59%.
January 1st to today, had you held that ETF thinking, and a lot of people did think at the beginning of the year, the market's going to go up this year big time, because it went up last year big time. And had you bought it at the beginning of the year, you would be down roughly 60%. And from where you started. So if you'd invested $1,000, you'd have $400 at this point.
Ow. Ow again. That's not fun. So it, when we think of the word investment, to be invested in something is really to take on ownership of it, to make it part of who you are, or to wrap yourself in it. If you're invested, you're part of the thing. If you're borrowing a bunch of money that you have to eventually sell something to pay back, that's not wrapping it around you. You're just buying it to see what it'll do. And in Latin, that's called speculate, to watch, spectate. That means that you're a speculator. You are not invested. You are hoping this goes up so that you can sell it. And there's another way of looking at that, and this is something I've said about venture capital for a long time. I've done a lot of work with venture capital in my career, and never enjoyable, by the way. And the way I describe them to startup companies that are looking into this stuff is that venture capital, they're the people that come to the wedding with the divorce papers signed. They are only getting involved so they can take as much as they can, but you can't continue without them because they're the only people available. That's kind of how I feel about speculators. They're buying a company not because they agree with what the company's doing or think that the company is profitable or think that the company is in some way creating value. And you can think about GameStop and a lot of the other meme stocks when you're talking about this. They're not buying it because they think GameStop is going to start being profitable in all its real estate-based stores selling video games on DVD discs when you don't even have a DVD drive on your computer anymore. This is not how people play computer games anymore. People aren't buying that company because they think GameStop is going to do something to become profitable. They're buying that company because other people are shorting the company, and it has nothing to do with what's going on in the real world. That's speculation. That's not investing. So from our perspective, a triple leveraged ETF is not, by definition, our definition, an investment.
Now, let me give you the other side of the story. And I want to emphasize, we do not recommend you get involved in this, but there is another side of the story. Had you, when the market, the serious short bear market that occurred in 2020, had you noted that everything was dark and gloomy and terrible, and you'd bought that same ETF around March 20th of 2020, it was about $9 a share. It's now about $35 a share. So had you bought it in March at the bottom of the market, now knowing when the bottom of the market is really easy looking back, but it's almost impossible to tell going forward, and you had held it till Friday, you would have more than tripled your money.
But if you'd bought in January, you'd be down 60%.
60%, right.
So you can see the attraction, people that are saying, I got to make a lot of money fast. It's gambling. It's like going to the racetracks and hoping. That's not something that we think you should base your future success on.
There's a whole subset of investors out there called market timers. And they say, okay, the market's high, I'm getting out. And then they nose around and say, this is the bottom of the market, I'm getting in. And they move in and out of the market fairly quickly. And they like to magnify their gains and losses because they have this gut feeling that they have charts or they have whatever. I actually watched an investor do that when I was a broker for several years, because he was trading through me as his broker. And I could actually saw what he did. And the problem is, in a bull market, market timers tend to make more money than other investors. But when the bear comes,
it eats the
bull. They generally tend to lose more than they made in the bull market. Therein is the difficulty. He traded in and out of the market. He was using leverage. It was before ETFs. He was using mutual funds that were leveraged. He was in a tax deferred position, so he didn't have to pay taxes on the trades. By the way, if you get in and out, you pay a lot of taxes. And he made money and made money and made money. And then along came a bear, a moderately nasty bear. And this is the amazing thing. He got out at the top, but then the bear went down. Actually, he didn't get out at the top. The market dropped. Now, I remember, the market dropped for the period of time he was waiting for it to drop before he was sure it was going to be a bear market. And he got out, and he had made money over this period of time. The day he got out of the market, it surged upward, and he waited because he said, this is a fake. This isn't real. The market ultimately was higher when he got back in than it was when he got out. And I measured it. And in a period of about 3 weeks, he had managed to lose all the money he had made the previous 3 years.
Ouch.
And that's basically the way market timing works. I tell you who will make money, though. Whoever is trading, whoever you buy the ETF from and through, and that makes a little money every time you do it.
And that's kind of goes back to our gambling analogy. The casinos did not get built because they're losing money. Those casinos got built not because you were winning money either. But if you think about like the game of poker, the casino doesn't take a hand in the game. They don't get a chance at the pot. But every time someone plays the game, they pay the casino. That's what these brokers are in this kind of speculative investment. The people that are sure to make money in that environment are the brokers. Now, here's the issue with that, is that when something is so speculative that when it's way down, people stop trading in it, even the brokers don't make money then. And you can see that in the crypto world right now. Not that there's a lot of brokerage fees, but there are brokerage fees. And if you look at the big coin exchanges, they charge something to be in business. You can see somewhere in there that they are making a profit or trying to on the trades. So when the crypto collapse occurred, which, by the way, we're having a second baby collapse in the crypto world in this last week. It is not going up while stocks go down. It's going down faster than the stocks are. And that shouldn't surprise everyone, but that's kind of what a lot of people were promising. Anyway, in the middle of that, the crypto exchanges, which some of them are listed on the exchanges in the United States as a publicly traded company, their profitability is getting eaten up as well because they have a certain number of employees and their overhead is a fairly fixed cost, and they were expecting a lot more trading or not a lot more on deposit or not a lot more loan fees, because anytime you have triple leverage, somebody's making money on the loan unless they lose all the money because it can't get paid back. So the profitability of even the brokers on the most speculative areas is in question, though not at the beginning. The beginning of these crazy bubbles, the brokers are convinced that this will go on forever. Anyway, that was a very big rabbit trail from triple leveraged.
Well,
but it also all came back to the same Warren.
Yes.
I actually didn't mix a metaphor there.
I was waiting for you to include Buffett.
No, I mean, I was thinking about putting Buffett in there, but that would have been, you know, this is maybe the first time in the history of our program that I started a metaphor and stuck to the same one from beginning to the end.
And didn't turn it into a pun.
Yeah, although my tongue has some sores on it from biting so hard to prevent myself from turning it into a pun. But we've got to play some commercials.
We do.
If you'd like to join the program, we have email addresses waiting for your email with bated breath. These servers have great deals of patience, but you're putting them to the edge of their patience by waiting to email. Please email jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or the Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important announcements. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
And we were kind of wrapping up on a subject and ready to start another one.
Right.
I have some interesting news on housing sales and so on. What do you have to talk about?
Well, we can talk about housing. We can talk about the general economy, I think, is important to take a look at. Every indicator that I see in the economy says the economy is running a little over its sustainable capacity. In other words, the economy is running really, really strongly. It has a lot of momentum. And one of my prime indicators is Walmart. I'm not recommending Walmart stock, but I can tell you that after warning that they were going to have some problems in the second quarter, during the second quarter and before they released their earnings, the CEO issued a warning that they were going to have a problem because they built up a bunch of inventory. They ordered a whole bunch of stuff during the pandemic that didn't come in. They ordered some more and people wanted it really, really badly. And the shelves were empty. And then they ordered some more. And of course, as soon as the supply chain started to relax, which it has done largely at this point, all those orders came flooding in. And at that moment, as the way retail works, consumers said, oh, we don't want to buy as much stuff from Walmart anymore. We want to go out to eat now and go to the movie. And Walmart said, but we ordered all this stuff because you wanted it. Oh, yeah, well, that's your problem. So Walmart, Target, and other big box retail stores, they warned we're going to be dumping a lot of inventory. It's going to hurt our earnings. Then something interesting happened. The whiplash whiplashed one more time. And after going out to eat and going to movies a few times, people said, no, I think I'll go back to Walmart and buy a bunch of stuff. So Walmart's earnings in the second quarter, which they just reported, are up 23% over the previous year's earnings at the same time. And they were doing really well the previous year. And they both Walmart and Home Depot were two indicators in my book, basically broke records for high earnings. Their revenues are up, their profits are up, they're going wonderfully and having a great time. And according to the earnings call from the CEO, it has continued through the summer that people are buying a lot of stuff. They're buying a lot of stuff from Home Depot. They're buying a lot of stuff is, by the way, what economists call goods. But I think it's unfair that you call it goods, because if you're in a symmetrical universe, and I think we are, there should be bads.
Well, I mean,
Bed Bath and Beyond is probably where the bads are.
Well, I mean, there's another thing. If you're getting little plastic stuff, we would call that goods, but they're not goods very long. They generally become bads very quickly in these. So it's just a stage in the life cycle of goods.
But in German, the word Bad, B-A-D, is a bath. So Bed Bath and Beyond would be Bed Bad and Beyond. So yeah, there's where the bads are.
Anyway, right now it's beyond bad. At the moment.
Bed Bad and Beyond is probably a good name for it at this point. But what I'm saying is, we are having a rip-roaring economy that's still going very, very strongly. There are some indications, and Jake wants to talk about those with the housings, and we can discuss that too. I think there's a very good reason for the housing sales slowdown that has nothing to do with the economy. But the general economy, and if you get this, is going very strongly. Yes, the yield curve is inverted. That sometimes precedes a recession. However, if the Federal Reserve is quietly, which I think they are, selling bonds on the open market at about the 2 and 3 year point, 2, 3 to 7 year point, which is about the maturity they have to sell, that would cause bond prices to go down in that time range, and thereby the yields go up, and that would produce an artificially inverted yield curve in treasuries. If that is what's happening, then we don't ever have any record of whether the yield curve inversion caused recessions in the past or was just an indicator of something else. It's kind of like if you heat somebody up in a sauna, that doesn't mean they have a fever,
but
it doesn't mean they're getting sick.
It might mean that they'll overheat.
It could mean they'll overheat, but
if somebody goes into a test
sauna and then takes their temperature as they leave the sauna, you will say, oh my God, this guy or this gal or this there or this them or whoever they are, has got a fever, they're sick, send them to the hospital. No, they just came out of the sauna. So, but it could be that the Fed has turned the heat up in the sauna a little bit, and therefore we're getting an inverted yield curve. Because I just frankly am not seeing the things out there that normally precede recessions.
So, yeah, and I'm going to come in with the other side of this. This is because we're economists. This is what we do. And it may sound like this is a disagreement. It's not. You have to look at both sides of everything. Okay.
Yeah. Snot.
Yes, yeah, snot. Snot a disagreement.
He said snot. Mama.
On the radio, too. Ew.
Yeah.
All right. So when you think about the yield curve, and why would an inverted yield curve be in any way an influencer on why you have a recession? Well, most business loans take place in that 2 to 5 year area. In the bond market and small businesses, they don't want to get a 30-year loan to buy a piece of equipment. It just doesn't seem feasible. It doesn't seem like a good idea. So they're getting a shorter-term loan. When interest rates in short-term loans go up, regardless of who's selling into the market, it makes it more expensive for businesses to expand. That's a piece of friction on the flow. It's not necessarily slowing you, but it's certainly not going to let you speed up for the same amount of energy. It's causing you to have to burn more energy to get the same effect, if you will. So there's some friction here that's being added in there. And that's kind of the leading rationale for when people say, why is it so regular that the yield curve inversion causes a recession? So this is the first time that during the measurement that we've been able to measure the actions of the Federal Reserve, because they've been extremely secretive over the majority of the Federal Reserve's history, where they may be the ones that are causing this inversion. It has the same effect. It's going to slow spending. It's going to cause things to get more expensive. but it's kind of a new tool, or at least new to the people watching. They may have had this tool in the basket for years, and this is the first time we're seeing it. They're not really announcing that that's what they're doing either, except that they are saying that they're selling $30 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities and about the same in treasury securities. And if they're just aiming in that area, that's $60 billion a month in that little middle area, which seems to be about the right amount to get the inversion that we're seeing. So how's that for a lot of really long-winded explanation of something most people don't even know exists?
Makes sense. But this is my point. As a business owner, according to NerdWallet, right now, the average bank small business loan is between 3.19 and 6.78%.
Yeah, that's still dirt cheap, although dirt is getting more expensive these days.
So despite the fact that we apparently have an inversion and should be seeing higher interest rates for those typical intermediate term bank loans, we're not.
And a big part of that is there's so much money still sitting out there in bank accounts that belong to these businesses. So they don't feel in great need of going out and getting a loan. That would push the interest rates up even faster. They feel good on the reserves. And that means that we don't see a major problem. They're not using loans for the expansion.
But we're about out of time. And one of the things I saw this month that caused me to think that inverted yield curve doesn't mean a lot right now is the fact that we saw in July a significant increase in business equipment purchases. When interest rates go up for business loans, businesses tend to slack off on the business equipment purchases. And in fact, they rose. And
a lot of that was cash purchase, and there's no interest rate issue there.
But some of it is borrowed.
Some of it is borrowed. But what I'm saying is that we have this big cushion that's never been there before when we've measured inversions. And that cushion is exactly what you're talking about. If sales aren't falling off of those big purchases, then the reason why the inverted yield curve in the past has caused a recession, it may not work this time. There you go.
And
we're about out of time for this hour.
1 minute left in this hour. We've got to tell who we are again.
Yeah. We've got another hour coming up where we will talk about just as interesting statistics as what we, yeah. There's a lot of people that are drooling on the floor at this point. But this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we do actually give personalized, customized fiduciary investment advice and portfolio management to people of higher net worth. And you can talk to us off the air about that stuff. We've got voicemail waiting during the weekend, but real live people, no phone trees during the week. You can find that number locally at
254-947-1111.
Or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter. It's weekly, comes out on Friday evenings. You can read the newsletter going back a long ways on the website. You can download the radio programs going back a long ways and then go to podcasts wherever they are. Contact us through email at jeff or jake at tpwc.com.